You're listening to the News Project podcast for the week of April 13th, 2020, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these stories: navigating the federal loan programs, a challenger for the state legislature, Meals on Wheels delivers, and the Easter Bunny arrives on time.
Is on the way from the federal government to help small businesses and their employees stay afloat during these challenging times, when many have been forced to shut their doors due to the COVID-19 emergency. But for some, the money hasn't come quickly enough, or there have been some frustrating bottlenecks they've had to deal with. Gregory Pullman, a senior vice president at Berkshire Bank, walks us through the process and the programs designed to help stabilize things until the virus has run its course. We held a Zoom interview with him on Friday, April 10th. First of all, Mr. Pullman, thank you very much for making the time available to talk with us today about the assistance that's going to be available or is already available, we hope, for folks who have been either lost their jobs or for small businesses that are struggling to stay afloat during this emergency here. So let's have you explain to us kind of what are some of the procedures and avenues in place for folks to kind of get some help here. And why don't we start then with this, the Payroll Protection Program, or PPP, or PPP as it's known. That's something new, I think, that came in place with the CARES Act that Congress passed a few weeks back for the $2 trillion package. Although this, that has... Congress set aside, I think, $349 billion. Billions, trillions, millions seem to kind of fall into place here. Anyway, so what does the Payroll Protection Plan do, and how is it supposed to work?
Okay. The Payroll Protection Program was put in place so that small businesses can keep paying their employees during these difficult times of, and allow them being the employees, to take care of their families, pay their bills, etc. Now, the small business can use 25% of whatever they qualify for to pay utilities, mortgage interests, and some of those expenses. So the plan is really geared towards the small business employee, okay, and keeping them on the payroll. For businesses that may have laid people off prior to the passing of PPP, they can bring those employees back and put them back on the payroll using the dollars they got from PPP. Prior to PPP, there was a program called EIDL, which is Economic Injury Disaster Loan. That is a direct program from SBA, which can be applied for at their website, and it's for up to $2 million. And you can use it for, other purposes, okay? You can't go to EIDL, borrow money for payroll, and then go into the PPP program and borrow money for payroll. They should be two different purposes.
So are those loans, like, forgivable, or how is it supposed to work? I mean, a small business is going to get some assistance to stay in business, keep their workers on the payroll, then what? Do they have to pay the money back eventually?
In the EIDL, the direct assistance, those loans are typically paid back with terms up to 30 years at 3.75% interest. Very reasonable. The PPP plan is forgivable if the company retains their employees, retains their payroll, and only uses no more than 25% of the money for those other purposes that I discussed. As long as they do that, then it is forgivable.
So it sounds like there's been a lot of bottlenecks and issues with getting the money out the door to folks that have applied. I've been hearing a lot of things like people waiting for hours on hold on the telephone, and websites that are crashing and all of that. This rollout, I gather, has not been smooth.
No, it hasn't, but I would say this. I would say everybody's trying to do the right thing, right? We all want to help. We all want our communities to get back thriving. I mean, the SBA had in the legislation 15 days to put this in place. They did it in six. They stood this program up in 6 days, okay? And there are some great people at the SBA that deserve a lot of credit for working around the clock to do that. But with anything, you know, you have a 30-plus year program in place called the SBA 7A program, and that's the program they've elected to have banks channel this money out into the business community. And you're kind of rewriting 30 years of kind of rules and regulations. There's a lot to be interpreted. There's a lot of guidance needed. I would say that as far as this program goes, it's kind of rolling guidelines, okay? Every day we get clarification. Every day we get guidance. So, you know, the initial bottleneck was, okay, the Treasury said you could go in and apply and get your money the same day. Well, we had gotten the guidelines from SBA on this program at the Thursday night before that press conference. So it was a scramble as we all tried to set up systems and processes to handle the onslaught of applications we knew we were going to get. So for instance, some banks opened up Friday and last Friday and accepted applications. We elected to spend the weekend kind of setting up process and procedures. So, you know, we probably got ballpark 2,000 applications on Monday. So there's your first bottleneck, right? All of these things come in. Then you have to look through them, look at them, make sure that they're, you know, their 941 tax report kind of jives with the amount that they're looking for. And so there is a little bit of labor intenseness that goes into these things. So that was the initial bottleneck. Now we're getting through ours and communicating with borrowers. My wife is a small business owner and she went to another bank and they said, we'll be ready at noon on Friday. And she applied and they said, well, we're not ready yet. We'll be ready sometime this weekend. Then she got in, then she got a confirmation that her application was accepted. And then they came back and asked her for more information, you know, 941s, the, you know, the information that you need. And we didn't know because we didn't have guidelines. So I apologize to go on a long way here, but it's important to understand what was stood up in the space of a few days to help American small businesses.
So do you think those bottlenecks are easing off at this point or will be easing off in the next week or so, so that this goes more smoothly?
Yeah, I believe so.
Or quickly or whatever.
Yeah, I believe so. From our perspective, you know, we work with our software vendor to create a portal and create a checklist and kind of do our best, even though there's some, you know, you got to set eyes on something, automate the intake and the processing. And my team, let me tell you, my team, 38 people, all hands on deck, you know, handling all the requests, not all the requests, but a lot of the requests from Berkshire Bank, because, you know, that's, we're the SBA lending department pretty much for Berkshire Bank. So the other bottleneck that needs to be identified is the bottleneck when you get to funding the loan. Okay. The first thing SBA said was, let me take a step back, Andrew. When you view these applications, then you put it into the SBA's system. Okay. And you do this one at a time, and it's manual. So you're putting it into SBA to get an approval in SBA to kind of lock up that money, okay? So that your borrower now knows they're locked in, they got a piece of that $349 billion. Then the SBA came out and said, well, you have to fund this loan in 5 days. Well, they had not provided any guidance on a note. They had not provided us guidance on how we should close these or how we should document these. And, you know, they, again, when I say rolling guidelines, they were coming out on a daily basis and providing us. Again, everybody trying to do the right thing, everybody trying to accomplish the same thing, but it was difficult. And so I'm just moving my camera there. So that now has become the next bottleneck. Now, with pushback in the industry, we've gotten that to 10 days now. So the SBA said, okay, you have 10 days from the day you get the SBA approval in our system, you have 10 days to document and fund the loan.
And I was just wondering, do you have to be a pre-existing account or a client of a particular bank to apply for one of these, or could you apply, could I apply to 3 or 4 banks and just hope to, you know, the first one responds is the one I go with?
That's a great question, and some people did that, and it's disheartening because we're working our tails off, and then we go do all this work, and we go put the deal into SBA system, and it goes boink, this person already has a loan. So we've exhausted to get to that point. And I understand small businesses are concerned. You know, look, I get it. I owned a small business, so I understand the anxiety. But what we've tried to do with our Berkshire customers is keep them updated, let them know that we got their back. We're taking care of them. But you don't have to have an account at a certain bank. But this is the issue, and it's important that the borrowers know this. You know, in the Act, they still emphasize to banks that you have to comply with bank secrecy. And Bank Secrecy Act has a lot of hoops and things to jump through about know your customer, right? So it's logical and practical to the first folks that you're going to help are the folks that you know and you can get done quickly, okay? So that's the reality. Now, as we get through our existing customers, we will discuss with executive management about going out and accepting applications from other folks.
So there's also been a lot of talk, at least up here in Southern Vermont, and I'm sure everywhere else, about where do independent contractors or the self-employed folks or people in the gig economy fit in? I mean, are they supposed to just basically do what you were just describing there? Call up the bank and say, hey, I need help, and what do I need to do? Is that how they fit in?
Well, mention is there's lots of information at treasury.gov. They have the application. They have frequently asked questions. They have a lot of good guidance there. So I would suggest they go there, because the way this program works, it's a little tricky, is if a business applies for PPP assistance, and they have 1099 employees or contracted employees, they're supposed to exclude that from their loan calculation and their wage, you know, their wages and payroll, because those 1099 employees are supposed to now, as of today, Friday, April 10th, own for assistance through PPP. So to answer your question, yeah, go to your bank, where you bank, and you can, again, download the application at treasury.gov and submit it to your bank. Treasury announced a huge backstop plan that I read on CNBC, where they're really stepping up to back this thing up. So I would say that, yeah, the $349 billion is going to get exhausted, but people, you know, there's so much fear-mongering and rumors out there that somebody emailed me the other day and said the money was gone on Monday. I said, no, it's not. Everybody calm down. Everybody relax. All right. Get your documentation together and apply at your bank. You should be okay if you do that right now. Now, I believe the Senate was discussing more funding last night, but it got shot down. A wise man and my business partner once told me, never bet against the U.S. economy. And I wouldn't bet against it. My biggest concern is a little bit self-centered, in that I've been 25 years in SBA lending. We are, most of my colleagues are very good stewards of this program. We do good work. But, you know, I fear for fraud from borrowers and potentially from lenders that are coming in to participate in this program who may not have been SBA lenders before. And, you know, in 2 or 3 years, if there's been fraud, they're going to expose it and they're going to give the SBA 7(a) program a black eye that it doesn't deserve, because nobody will remember the anxiety, the stress, and everything that we've all gone through to make this happen.
Well, Mr. Pullman, thank you once again for your time. I'll let you get back to processing those loans or whatever.
Yeah.
And wish you and your colleagues well through this very difficult period. And thanks again for making the time to talk with us and share your insights into all of this.
My pleasure, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Last week, Seth Bongartz, who until recently served as the president and executive director of Hildene, the Lincoln family home in Manchester, announced he was planning to wage a campaign for the Democratic Party's nomination for one of the two state representative seats from the district that includes Manchester, Arlington, Sandgate, and most of Sunderland. Bongartz has served in the state legislature before. He represented Manchester for 2 terms during the 1980s, before the town was redistricted into part of the current 2-member district. He also served 1 term in the state Senate, before going into law practice full-time. We had a chance to talk with Seth about his decision to throw his hat into the ring and compete for one of the 2 seats, which are currently held by Representatives Cynthia Browning and Kathleen James. In the press statement that announced his candidacy, Bongartz said he and Kathleen James would be running a joint campaign as a team.
So, I guess, basic question just to kind of get us started here. What made you decide to run?
Well, I've been thinking about it, and I've been, you know, frankly thinking that I could contribute, and then combination of the coronavirus, and I think, you know, then what happened with Cynthia Browning and the forcing everybody to come back, and I just put it all together and said, yeah, I really think I can contribute, and I think I can be a constructive force, and this is the time to do it.
So did Cynthia's motion there on that quorum call play a role in your thinking? Was that like a tipping point kind of situation, or?
It did help me decide. I think, you know, I don't want to talk about that for this whole interview, because I really want to, you know, but move beyond that. But I think that when you have the leadership of the all three parties searching for a way to avoid putting members at risk during this pandemic, and then to have one member torpedo that tripartite effort of the leadership to keep people safe, this just isn't right.
So looking ahead, you know, and past the COVID-19 emergency that we're in currently, what will be some of the key elements of your platform or some of the key issues you expect to emphasize going forward between now and
January? You know, it's really interesting, because we are going to be dealing with so much unknown. And I think the next session, next couple of years, are going to be about virtually nothing except digging us out of the hole that this coronavirus has created. The first thing we're going to have to do, obviously, is make sure that we're taking care of Vermonters. Healthcare, food, and some sort of level of basic income. And then the second part will be, how do we rebuild the economy? And, I don't pretend to have brilliant ideas or solutions at this moment in time, because frankly, nobody does, because nobody even knows what we're dealing with. And the degree to which, the degree of difficulty will be related to what the federal government does over the next 6 months, both in terms of the health of people and what happens with the economy and how much help comes from the federal government. But it's really an unknown. And what I really realized about this is that it's going to require a lot of collective thinking and a lot of working together closely to figure out solutions as we go. And so I just really decided I think that's one of the things I'm really good at, is working collaboratively with people. And I just think that's going to be more important than ever. So, you normally in these situations, you would be talking about all kinds of things like, I don't know, the environment or other issues. But, I think for the next couple of years, it's going to be focused on making sure that Vermonters are okay, the people who live in our district and our county and our state are okay as best we can. And then it's going to be about jobs and rebuilding the economy. That's what we're talking about.
I was just thinking back to some of the issues that were sort of front and center there back in January. It seems like a long time ago now, like paid family leave and minimum wage and cannabis reform and education spending. I mean, are those things basically dead for now until next January, or do you think there's still a possibility that the legislature should, in some form or another, perhaps in an extended session that would drag on into the summer, get back to focusing on some of those things that seemed so important back in January?
Well, of course, in a way, they're going to remain important because, they were important for a reason and are going to remain important. The timing is going to be everything on this, I think. The one thing we don't want to do, now by a mile more than ever, is put any stress on our small businesses beyond what they're already feeling. And at the same time, we have to just make sure we're taking care of people. The federal government's response on for people to be able to get the $600 on top of what the state's done has really been a lifesaver, and we'll see how long that lasts. It's just so hard to tell how those issues are going to play out and how much sense it's going to make to move forward hard on them in this new, we're in a new world. I'm somebody who, I know that, like, you take the minimum wage on a federal level, if we go back to what the minimum wage was in, I saw this story and I can't remember the exact numbers, but from the mid 70s, and if we had just kept up with inflation, the minimum wage would now be $22 an hour. So, workers in those jobs are clearly falling behind year after year after year, and it's harder and harder as the minimum wage isn't keeping up with anything and so would I have been a supporter of the minimum wage bill that passed the legislature? Yeah, I would have. But I think that's done, and that's where it is. Paid family leave, I'm for it philosophically, but we're going to just have to, be honest and say we're going to have to really look at the economic landscape and really prioritize about what's most important for helping Vermonters get back on their feet when we get to Montpelier in January, whoever the we is.
The primary election that will determine who the Democratic slate of candidates for the two seats will be held on August 11th. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Meals on Wheels is one of the ways many Bennington County residents who either can't get out to go food shopping or who are living with disabilities obtain healthy, nutritious meals delivered straight to their homes. The program serves seniors who are over the age of 60 and is an independent nonprofit organization that's administered in Bennington County by the Council on Aging. They've seen a surge in the number of meals they are being asked to deliver as the COVID-19 emergency has led to sheltering in place and social distancing. Now more than ever, the seniors who have signed up for the program need the support of the food deliveries, as well as the contact, if from a distance during the COVID-19 emergency, of the volunteer drivers.
So this is our meal that went home today. It's a stuffed pepper. We stuffed it with fresh ground chicken, rice, and herbs, and some fresh broccoli and fresh carrots. And we're so grateful for all the donations that we get gleaned from the local markets, and that we're so grateful to be able to service our clientele through this pandemic. They're grateful, they're you know, we're keeping them home, we're keeping them healthy with a nutritious meal every day. Our clientele has doubled, if not almost tripled now, so the mass productions of food is daily for us. But we enjoy what we do, we stay healthy, we practice healthy procedures here, and we're just grateful to be able to do this for our clientele and the community.
Mornings at their headquarters in Bennington see several volunteer drivers pulling in to pick up the meals prepared by the staff, which they then take out across the entire county, all the way from Pownall to Rupert, for home deliveries. The meals are loaded into cars and then they head out on their routes. Ilsa Svoboda, the executive director of Bennington County Meals on Wheels, tells us how it's all going during the COVID-19 emergency.
What we had to do when this all started was each of our clients was getting a delivery 5 days a week from Monday to Friday. Every day has been different. So as the weeks have gone by, what we had to do was to decrease the amount of times we go out to see a client. So what we've done is one client will get one delivery per week and get one hot meal, and then between five and six frozen meals. So that way, the driver who goes to the door, rings the doorbell, steps back at least six feet, waits for the person to come to the door. The person then takes the food in, the driver leaves. If the person does not answer the door, the driver then calls the office, and then we have a chain of commands that we call the emergency contact, and then make sure that the person is okay. We also, because we have our deliveries down to 1 day a week per person, we have volunteers that make well call check calls for us. So they call the client between 3 and 4 times a week to make sure that the client is okay. If the client doesn't answer the phone, the protocol is to call our office, and then we call the emergency contact for that as well. So the client is being seen by our driver once a week and then called between 3 and 4 times a week. I have to tell you that the Vermont community has been absolutely fabulous in responding to a newspaper article that came out about volunteer drivers. We've had to increase our driver capacity by these volunteers, which have been fabulous. And we also, it's due to the fact that we have doubled our amount of clients within the last couple of weeks. So, but it takes a lot more for us to prepare the meals. And with the increase of the food costs at this time, with making sure that people stay healthy, in delivering and within my staff to stay healthy, it's been a challenge financially, and aside from being partially funded, we need the donations.
Under normal times, the building on Pleasant Street in Bennington, along with 4 other sites across the county, provide meals on site for seniors, which is often an important source of social interaction for the clients of Meals on Wheels. But right now, of course, the building is closed off to all but the staff. In a typical year, the 25-year-old nonprofit organization delivers over 50,000 healthy meals annually to the county's senior community, as well as people living with disabilities across the county. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. It may have been a different Easter from normal, but some things do remain eternal, like the Easter Bunny, who stopped in for a visit to Arlington on Sunday afternoon by the Battenkill Valley Health Center. That's where we met up with Kate Bryan, who filled us in on what was going on.
Here at Battenkill Silicon Valley Health Center, we host an annual fundraiser called Breakfast with the Easter Bunny, and we have that the week before Easter normally, and this year we had to cancel. So we have a lovely Easter Bunny friend who was willing to help us out today, so even though we couldn't keep our normal tradition going, we were able to tweak it a little bit and give some cheer to folks as they drive by.
There are lots of smiles and horns honking for the Easter Bunny, who plans to be back here next year. We'll hope it was a good Easter for you as well. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.